The Struggle for Libya. Today, Thursday, June 26th, this is The World. I'm Carol Hills, and for Marco Werman, a prominent human rights activist in Libya is assassinated in her own home.
She was known as a very hopeful, optimistic, defiant person with a very strong presence. She'd basically leave a mark on people.
We'll hear how her death is part of Libya's larger turmoil, also how the number of migrant children caught at the U.S. border compares to the number of refugees in the Middle East.
10,000 children in 1 month here in the United States. I mean, we're talking about 10,000 people crossing the border into Jordan every day.
And later, our in-house soccer guru heads off to the World Cup in Brazil.
Yeah, I can barely contain myself. I'm so excited.
Plus, how World Cup soccer lets you lose and win at the same time. All after the news.
Support for PRI's The World comes from Medtronic, celebrating people living with medical technology who are giving back to their communities. Apply for the Bakken Invitation Award and earn a $20,000 charitable grant for your charity. Learn more at liveongiveon.org.
I'm Carol Hills, in for Marco Werman. This is The World. 2 years ago, it was jubilation in Libya as people celebrated the first election after the fall of dictator Muammar Gaddafi. No such joy after Libya's second post-revolution vote. Turnout was low for parliament elections this week. It was hoped the vote would bring some stability to Libya's chaotic political scene. But hours after human rights lawyer Salwa Bougagas cast her ballot, she was shot and stabbed multiple times in her home. Bougagas later died from her wounds at a hospital. Many Libyans are mourning her death today. Reporter Marine Olivesi is in Tripoli and tells us why.
She was known as a very hopeful, optimistic, defiant person with a very strong presence. She'd basically leave a mark on people. One Libyan journalist this morning, we saw her a couple of weeks ago, told me everybody's got something to say, but when she speaks, we'd all listen. The news of her death sent a shockwave across Libya and beyond.
Put her death in context. I mean, in terms of the dynamic right now in eastern Libya, in terms of this struggle between these two very different points of view.
The radical group Ansar al-Sharia, which is believed to be related to al-Qaeda, has been, over the past 2 years, operating rather freely inside the city and elsewhere in eastern Libya. And they're thought to be responsible for a string of assassination, car bomb. And what happened last month, is that one former general, Khalifa Iftar, declared an open war on those radical Islamists without really the approval or the authorization of central authorities. Some officials have rallied behind Haftar and favored direct and forceful confrontation because they say that's the only way to get rid of radical insurgents. But others actually think that it's just been dragging Libya, especially the eastern part of the country, even closer to a state of civil war.
Now, her assassination came on a turbulent day of voting. What else happened?
Well, some polling stations stayed closed for security reasons in eastern Libya, for instance, in Derna, which has become the headquarters of that group I mentioned, Ansar al-Sharia. Officials said Islamist insurgents opened fire on a security group that was on patrol with at least 30 people wounded. But again, as I said, this is part of the daily scenes of violence that has been rocking Benghazi, especially for the past month and a half.
Now, I understand there was pretty low turnout in yesterday's vote. Was violence the biggest factor keeping people away?
Well, not really. Maybe in a few places in eastern Libya, yes, but not in most part of the country. As you say, the turnout was really low. Only about a third of those who voted in the last parliamentary elections in July 2012 showed up to cast their ballots yesterday. I went to a few polling stations here in Tripoli, and it was very quiet indeed. There was no queuing up, none of the scenes of jubilation that I'd seen 2 years ago. I remember that election in 2012 as being kind of a big party all over Tripoli, with cars honking all day, Libyans waving flags on the streets. The mood yesterday was strikingly different, not really because of any threat of violence, at least not in the capital, but because of a certain apathy from most Libyans. They're not enthused at all because they're saying that the central authorities are weak. They've been powerless at fixing any of Libya's problems, and that has made a lot of people lose hope that things are going to be any different this time around, even with new representatives.
Now, there's a lot of moving parts in play right now, a lot of people vying for power. Who's in charge of the country right now?
Well, right now, Libya's Muslim Brotherhood Party is the leading force in the General National Congress. And the big question mark, of course, is whether these elections will change the balance of power. The irony is, even as results have started to be made public, we might not have an answer for that question before several weeks, because all the candidates ran on an independent platform. There were no party lists this time. So they all used very general and cliché slogans for reconciliation, security, but they all ran on very mainstream platform. So most likely Libyans won't really know who's won or which political force will emerge from the new parliament until the new representatives take office in a month from now after Ramadan.
That's reporter Maureen Olivesi in Tripoli. Thanks, Maureen.
My pleasure.
In Iraq, Sunni militants continue to make progress in their battle against the Iraqi government. Fighting was reported overnight just an hour's drive northeast of Baghdad. The main extremist group is known as ISIS, the Islamic State in Iraq and Greater Syria. We've been reporting all week about ISIS, who its fighters are, their goals, and their alliances. Today, we're digging into the group's finances. Matt Levitt directs the counterterrorism program at the Washington Institute for Near East Policy. He also used to investigate terrorist finances for the FBI and the Treasury Department. Matt, we've heard how the militants managed to loot several hundred million dollars in cash when they took Mosul, but they were making money way before that, right?
They were, and especially in Mosul for a very long time. And in Iraq, unlike other places where al-Qaeda affiliates and al-Qaeda corps raise money through the abuse of charity and charitable donations, al-Qaeda in Iraq, which later became the Islamic State of Iraq, which is now ISIS or ISIL, traditionally raised money through corruption and criminal activity and are one of the better funded groups we know of.
I mean, when you read about them, it sounds like they're almost a sort of government unto themselves in terms of the range of activities they're in to raise money. Can you talk about the range of things they are involved in?
Everything from oil smuggling, which they've been involved in since at least 2007, extortion, protection rackets, taxing minority communities, robberies, bank heists, kidnapping for ransom. And this is not new. This really goes back to at least 2006.
So where does this money live? You know, you have a huge pile of cash somewhere. I mean, how do they actually make transactions with all this money that they're getting?
Well, we think they move their money out the door pretty quickly in the form of payments. They have a lot of expenses, especially salary payments and payments to the families of people who are killed or imprisoned. When they move money, there is some money that is moved through the banking system, and there's some money that's moved through informal financial transfer mechanisms like hawala systems and, of course, cash couriers.
We heard about that hawala system. Describe it for us.
Hawala, which means trust, is an informal banking system where money actually doesn't move at all. So if you want to send money from Boston to Pakistan, you'll find a hawala dealer in the Boston area. You'll give them $1,000 plus a few bucks as their fee, and they'll contact a hawala dealer that they know and trust and do business with in Pakistan. And your friend in Pakistan will come with the right code, and they'll get $1,000. It's a very, very old and reliable way of sending money.
Now, in a previous job, you were actually tracking terrorist finances. In that job, how would you track ISIS's finances?
Well, back in the day, when we had boots on the ground in Iraq, we had a special unit in Iraq, the Iraq Threat Finance Cell, where Treasury and the military and intelligence agencies and law enforcement all cooperated together to follow the money. And that meant everything from training military, when they did raids, to look for pocket litter that would have something to do with finances, to working with banks and working with and establishing relationships with local hawala dealers so that you could collect that information. And of course, all the way up to much more sophisticated signals intelligence and whatnot. Today, without those boots on the ground, that's much more difficult. So it's a little depressing, having worked on this for a long time, to have seen the successes we had pushing back al-Qaeda in Iraq back in the day, to see them come back so strong now militarily and financially. I think the mistake was that some people thought that because they were pushed back militarily, they were also crushed financially, which they clearly were not, and the financial resources were what they needed to regenerate. The good news is that we do have an understanding of how groups like ISIS are financed. There are things we can do to not only push them back militarily, but to constrain their financial resources. And we're going to have to do these in tandem in ways that we apparently didn't really do very well for the past few years.
Matt Levitt is a former counterterrorism official. He's now with the Washington Institute for Near East Policy. Thanks so much, Matt.
Always a pleasure.
There's an experiment in democracy taking place in China right now. More than 700,000 people have already cast their votes in an informal poll, a referendum held in Hong Kong on how the territory's residents should be allowed to choose their own leader. It's just a symbolic vote, but China's communist rulers are not amused. Beijing is determined to keep control over who rules the former British colony. David Wertheim is following the vote and the reaction to it in China. He's an editor at Foreign Policy magazine.
It has no legally binding effect. The intent is once electors have made their choice between the three possibilities, none of which can be interpreted as pro-Beijing, the one most popular possibility will be put forth for a vote on the island. Now, again, as you say, this is a bit more of a survey than anything else. In particular, it's being held online. Voters can vote using a smartphone app. Participation has actually been quite high, and I think quite a bit higher than the organizers originally expected. And even though it's obviously a small number, it's certainly enough to get the attention of mainland Chinese authorities.
So in some way, it's kind of needling the central government in Beijing, saying we want a more direct way to elect the person who runs Hong Kong. That's the idea, isn't it?
I think that's right. It's certainly a statement to Beijing. And it's also a statement, I think, internally. This shows that whatever saber-rattling Beijing may engage in, this can be organized, again, both online and offline at polling stations, a couple dozen, give or take, around the city. So certainly this is something that Beijing looks down upon. On June 23rd, a state-run outlet called the Global Times issued an editorial that said that this was laughable and illegal. So clearly they are paying attention.
Why is Beijing even reacting? Doesn't it sort of suggest that they're sort of threatened by even a sort of social media discussion about a change in how the head of Hong Kong is elected?
If indeed this is a vote which has absolutely no effect whatsoever, you would think that Beijing would feel confident in ignoring it. But instead, they've gone on the offensive. And it's interesting to note the June 23rd Global Times editorial, which took aim at this referendum, was also issued in English. This is clearly a case where they want international attention on this issue. And I think there's a real risk that it backfires because obviously they're not trying to win or not successfully winning hearts and minds here. And I think what it speaks to, of course, is the fact that you actually have a hard count. Whatever its imperfections, the fact is that this election allows people to be counted. And Beijing, mainland China, has no such mechanism. Then you have something separate, which is the social media discussion within Chinese cyberspace, where basically anybody can participate. And you certainly don't see hundreds of thousands of people participating, but those who are choosing to speak out are in many cases poking fun at Beijing, or at the very least poking fun at the Global Times approach to managing this.
Are you getting any defenders of the current system and defenders of the government in the social media chat about it?
There certainly are defenders, you know, some who say that if an election were held, the majority would choose to stay the course. Others, you know, who have leveled ad hominem attacks at those who question the Beijing line. But I think there's always suspicion as to whether those voices are actually real or are members of the so-called 50-cent party, which means they're paid by the government to espouse pro-government views. So it's always hard to tell. You always have to read the tea leaves, so to speak, when you deal with China's social media. But it certainly does seem that there's a strong strand of discussion that is very skeptical toward the argument that if 1.3 billion people could vote, it would be a slam dunk in favor of keeping Hong Kong close.
David Wertheim is a senior editor at Foreign Policy magazine. He specializes in social media. Thank you so much, David.
Thanks so much.
This is PRI.
The World is brought to you by PRI and supported by TiVo, able to search cable TV, on-demand libraries, and streaming content from Netflix and Hulu Plus on a single screen, available at TiVo.com.
I'm Carol Hills, in for Marco Werman, and this is The World. For more than 6 months, South Sudan has been gripped by civil unrest. Tensions in the world's newest nation began last summer when the South Sudanese president, Salva Kiir, fired his deputy, Riek Machar. By December, those tensions turned into ethnic violence between Kiir's Dinka people and Machar's tribe, the Nuer. More than 1 million South Sudanese refugees have since fled the violence, and an estimated 45,000 of them have taken shelter at a United Nations camp in Bentiu on the South Sudanese border with Sudan. But conditions in the camp have taken a turn for the worst. According to a recent report by Doctors Without Borders, we've reached Raphael Gorgeau in South Sudan. He's the country director for Doctors Without Borders. There. What are the conditions like at the camp right now?
Yeah, as you said, I mean, in the camp now, we are facing a situation where 45,000 people have moved into this camp, which is creating a lot of difficulty for humanitarian organizations to provide proper assistance. This means that today there are about 6 liters of water per person per day. And normally in this kind of setting, the minimum is 15 liters of water per person per day. There is basically one latrine for 170 people, where the minimum in such condition is one latrine for 20 people. So the consequences of that, a lot of children, especially children under 5 years old, dying from different diseases, diarrhea, for instance, and pneumonia.
So you've mentioned there's a lack of water. There's hardly any latrines. You know, I read that there was only 2,000 displaced at this camp a few months ago, and then you mentioned it's now 45,000. What propelled so many people to come? What has happened in the last 2 months that drove so many people to Bentiu?
We've seen a lot of fighting in Bentiu and around Bentiu. So this actually pushed people to go to this camp to get protection there. So as you said, a few months ago, there were only 2,000 people. So the conditions in the camp were not that bad. Then from 2,000, it moved to 22,000 people. Then it moved to 38,000. So it was already more difficult. And now we're talking about 45,000 people. A lot of people have been coming because where they live, they don't have food anymore.
They're seeking safety, they're seeking food, and the irony is they're not getting either at the camp because it's so overloaded with people fleeing violence. Raphael, who are these people who are at the camp? Are they Nuer? Are they Dinka? Does it matter? Is it less defined than we think?
In the camp in Bentiu, there is a mixed population of Nuer and Dinka. Most of the population are civilians, a lot of women and children.
What are the people in the camps telling you and others working there about what it's like where they're living, about sort of the violence and what's going on? Are they sort of describing the scenes?
What is interesting is to discuss with the new people arriving in the camp. They walk for hours to come to this camp. They describe actually a lack of food where they are because there is no supply going to these villages. And I think that it's really their last choice to go to Bentiu, making sure that they can be actually safe and they can have basic food.
And the division that we see at the top between the president, who's Dinka, and Riek Machar, who's a Nuer, those divisions, do they exist in the camp as well?
It does exist in the camp, but so far we haven't seen any major tension or incidents between the two communities.
We've been speaking with Raphael Gorgeau, the South Sudan country director for Doctors Without Borders. Thanks so much, Raphael.
You're welcome.
And then there were 16. At the World Cup, I mean. After today, 16 teams are left standing in Brazil, still chasing soccer's ultimate trophy. And the big news from Brazil? The U.S. is still in it. We'll have more on that later in the show. Meanwhile, as I speak, 14 contestants are hard at it in another much smaller but similarly international competition in Queens, New York. It's a long-distance road race, arguably even more epic than the games in Brazil. From our ultra-marathon desk, Bruce Wallace reports.
A lot of the time, road races are all the Shri Chinmoy Self-Transcendence 3100-mile race is more the Enthusiasm Awakeners sang encouraging mantras for the runners assembled at a high school in Queens, New York, on a recent Sunday morning, 3 days into the World Cup. A race organizer introduced the runners. They're 14, from Russia, Ukraine, Slovakia, Bulgaria, Austria, Australia, Switzerland, Scotland, one from the U.S. The clock nears 6 a.m.,
on your marks, set, go!
There's a lot of other stuff that sets this race apart from your typical long-distance run. For one, it's really long distance. 3,100 miles. They run from 6 in the morning until 12 at night, covering 60 or 70 miles every day for a month and a half. And they do it all without leaving this one city block. They go round and around about 110 times a day. The race, and most of its runners, are inspired by the teachings of Sri Chinmoy, an Indian spiritual guru who relocated to this corner of New York City in the 1960s and set up a school. Chinmoy urged his disciples to test the limits of what they considered possible.
His philosophy behind putting on such long races was it gave runners an opportunity to go beyond what their conception is that their capacity is.
Sahishnu Seshal has been involved in the races since they began in the late 70s.
He felt that people have unlimited capacity if they can tap into an inner resource. And when they become athletes, he always encourages them to be alert and to practice concentration while they're running.
Chinmoy foot races got longer and longer and spread across the globe. This is the 18th year of the 3100, which calls itself the longest certified foot race in the world. Chinmoy died in 2007, but he's still everywhere at the race. His pictures and quotes adorn the starting line, and it's his songs that the Enthusiasm Awakeners sing to the runners each morning. Ten days later, the day of the infamous bite at the World Cup, they're still running. Volunteers count off each lap.
23, Basu. Ranjal, 40.
The runners are working through some physical troubles, but Chinmoy races are, as the followers say, as much an inner race as a physical one. William Sitchell, a 60-year-old from Scotland, has done a bunch of long runs. But as we walk-ran together, he told me that the duration makes this one totally different.
Just relentless. You know, you get up every morning and there's a monkey in the corner, 109, 110 laps, you know, sort of, and you think, oh, God, you know. But you try not to think of it too much. Don't obsess about the laps.
Instead, Sitchell focuses on the minutiae of the course, the variation as he circles the block.
It's like each side of the course feels like a bit like a different world. Again, it almost feels like you're on a different course.
This is Australian Sarah Barnett's second go at the race. When she started last year, she kind of wished she was on a different course.
I got a bit depressed the first few weeks because I'd go past this main road here and think, oh man, I wish I was out in a forest somewhere, or, you know, it's not exactly the most scenic place. But, you know, we have to be able to meditate here, right in the middle of New York, you know. So.
Barnett was one of four runners who didn't finish the race last year. But she ran 2,600 miles and is going strong this year. A lot of the people who do finish keep coming back for more. They say Chinmoy's teachings about self-transcendence still drive them.
Nidrivi 109.
I stopped by the race again right before midnight. The runners were making their last laps for the day. The fastest was getting close to 700 miles. At that rate, it only has another 34 days, or 4,373 laps around the block. For The World, I'm Bruce Wallace, Queens, New York.
And you're listening to PRI, Public Radio International. I'm Carol Hills. Coming up, some call it antique clothing, others call it rags.
I sometimes can hear people off the street, you know, saying, they've got dirty t-shirts, you know, hanging in that window. But to me, that's what I see the beauty in that.
Plus, the latest from the World Cup, including the weather, just ahead.
Support for PRI's The World comes from Medtronic, celebrating people living with medical technology who are giving back to their communities. Apply for the Bakken Invitation Award and earn a $20,000 charitable grant for your charity. Learn more at liveongiveon.org. And by Lookout, using big data and predictive analytics to protect people and organizations from mobile threats worldwide. More information at lookout.com.
I'm Carol Hills in for Marco Werman. This is The World, a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH Boston. And what a day at the World Cup drama. And we're going to jump right in with the world's soccer guy, William Troop, who's going to tell us about the loss of the U.S., but it's still not bad news. Go for it.
It's excellent news, actually. This is one of those moments in soccer where some people might find it a little confusing, but it's good news. The U.S. lost today to Germany. The game went on even though there was standing water all over the place, but the game went on. The end result is the U.S. and Portugal end up second in the group with the same number of points, but the U.S. has a better goal differential, the difference between goals scored and goals allowed. That means that the U.S. goes through and Portugal is eliminated. So it's great, great news for the U.S. The U.S. is now on to the round of 16 at the World Cup, the 16 top teams in the world. So couldn't be better.
Wow. So the U.S. and Germany move ahead. Who gets left out?
Well, Ghana and Portugal were the two teams that were playing the other match in this Group G of the World Cup. Portugal won 2-1. But as I said, it wasn't enough to come out ahead of the United States. That's a little sad for me as a soccer fan because that means the tournament loses Cristiano Ronaldo, the best player arguably on the planet right now, reigning world player of the year. He really didn't do enough at this World Cup to help Portugal stay. He scored his first goal in the tournament only today. It wasn't enough, so they go home. And Ghana, on the other hand, the story there is that this was a team that never looked very united from the beginning. They fell apart as the tournament went on. They played today's game without two of their best stars who they sent home for indiscipline. I mean, it was just a mess.
And of course, I can't leave you without talking about the biggest World Cup controversy, the biter. What's the latest on that?
Yes, Uruguay's Luis Suarez, who I'm sure most of our listeners heard earlier this week, sunk his teeth into an Italian defender. I could hardly believe it when I saw that. He actually has been suspended. His World Cup is over. FIFA kicked him out of the tournament and suspended him for 4 months from playing any soccer at all anywhere. That's not going to be good news for his regular employer, the team Liverpool in England. So I have to say that's good news for soccer because it's a no-brainer. No biting in soccer, period.
No biting anywhere, really. And of course, you are heading yourself to Brazil very soon.
Yes, I'm very excited. Today's results actually mean that I will be at the next U.S. game, which will be next week on Tuesday in Salvador, and I will be in the stands to cheer them on.
Have a fantastic trip, William.
Thanks.
The world's Brazil-bound soccer madman, William Troop. And for all of you celebrating the U.S. going through in Brazil, our World Cup predicting ocelot, Izzy, would like to remind you he got it right. Germany for the win. But he says it was all part of the plan. Follow Izzy as he predicts the next U.S. game. He's on Twitter at IzzyPicks. That's IzzyPicks. Now, about that Ghana meltdown that William mentioned, there's more to the story, actually. The Ghanaian players almost went on strike before today's game against Portugal. They said they would refuse to play unless their country's soccer federation came up with millions of dollars in back pay. Ghana's president himself intervened to make sure that $3 million in cash were flown to Brazil to pay the players. The incident made huge headlines back in Ghana, and they were not flattering for anyone involved. Vera Kwakofi is current affairs editor for our friends at BBC Africa in London. She's also Ghanaian herself. I asked her to describe Ghanaians' reaction to all of this.
Disappointed, angered that actually there was a campaign to bring the boys back from Brazil because I think Ghanaians did not want to support the team behaving as badly as they had. And to be honest with you, if they had played this game in Ghana or anywhere near the African continent, they'd have been booed.
They would have been booed. So Ghanaians may not be that sad that Ghana lost today, given the feelings about the team.
They're sad that their name has been dragged in the mud because they expected to make a name for the team, especially because of their, you know, how well they've done in previous World Cups in 2006 and 2010, coming close to the semifinals. And therefore, at the very least, people expected that they would acquit themselves. And if they left the tournament early, they'd leave honorably. And that has not been the case with their off-the-pitch antics. So I think Ghanaians are a bit, despondent about their behavior. I think people always rallied around the team to protect the name of Ghana, but on this one, I don't think that they have endeared themselves to the nation.
How about you, Vera? How do you feel personally about it, having sort of high hopes and then having this happen?
When the draw was made, I didn't really think we had a good chance of coming out of the group with the pedigree of Portugal and Germany anyway. But I felt that we would be able to do enough to walk away with some pride. And I was quite shocked, actually, by the off-the-ball incidents and the behavior in the camp, which disappointed me, certainly, as a Ghanaian. And this behavior just was terribly un-Ghanaian and let the country's pedigree down.
Ghanaian journalist Vera Kwakoffi with our partners at BBC Africa in London. Now, all the soccer fans who've traveled to Brazil for the World Cup already know this. It's expensive to find a place to stay there right now. Many hotels and inns have jacked up their prices for the duration of the tournament, but not everybody is paying those inflated prices. Some World Cup tourists have found much cheaper lodging in Rio's poorest neighborhoods, the favelas. Hannah Bratton from Rhode Island decided to stay in a favela, in a place called the Maze Inn. She told my colleague Marco Werman about her favela experience so far.
So we're living up at the top of this favela, and almost all the way at the top, they've got this little soccer field. And the kids and the teenagers are constantly playing on the field. When we first got here, I was so excited. I jumped in and was trying to keep up with the kids and even pull the muscle a little bit because I was so excited of just to be here in Brazil for the Cup, playing football on a pitch with these kids who live and breathe the sport.
Tell us about the Maze. You're there right now, right?
Yeah, so this wonderful, wonderful place was started by a man named Bob Nadkarni. He used to be a BBC correspondent, came to Rio in 71. He came here and built this beautiful bed and breakfast, they call it. It's a very, very unique place because he is this sort of community figure and really took leadership in turning the favela, which formerly had a lot of issues with police corruption. He turned it into this place of wonderful community.
And for you, Hannah, was this about affordability or was it the possibility of a unique Brazilian experience offered by the favelas?
You know, it was about both. I knew that I was going to have to spend a pretty penny to be able to come here. But the Maze, their prices are a little bit higher during the World Cup, but it was within my affordability range. And it's just the most unique sort of grassroots experience you could have in Brazil. I mean, I'm able to speak with Brazilians who live here and have grown up here for all of their lives.
That sounds really cool. You know, you're staying in this place, the Maze, but it's kind of established, it sounds. Some people, I gather, are kind of doing an Airbnb thing, renting out their homes, and they could actually stand to make a decent amount of money from that during the World Cup. Do you think favela stays are going to become a trend? Is the World Cup the moment when this takes off?
For a lot of people, this is their first time even considering coming to Brazil and staying in a favela. And because there's so much attention on Brazil right now, yeah, I do think that it could be a trend. But I got to say that Bob Nadkarni and his wife Malu and this place, the Maze, is set apart from the other favelas, from what I hear, because of this deeply rooted change of mentality within the community. It's not a slum. It is a community. The Maze also doubles as a jazz club. So once a month, they have these jazz nights and they have up to 500 people coming into the place. I can't tell you how, what a pleasure it is to stay here because of this community vibe.
Sounds like it's going to be hard to leave.
Oh, super hard to leave. Yep.
Hannah Bratton, who came from Rhode Island to Brazil to attend the World Cup and is staying in a favela. Thanks very much, Hannah. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
I guess it's not too surprising that the way you describe something can change the way you see it. For instance, we just heard favela slum versus vibrant community. Here's another example from our friend Alina Simone.
It's amazing how a casual choice of words can change your perspective when it comes to used clothing. Calling that sweater a hand-me-down invites flashbacks to tragic dances in a high school gym. Call it vintage or consignment, all of a sudden makes it hipster chic. But what if you call it antique clothing for the body?
I sometimes can hear people off the street, you know, saying they've got dirty t-shirts, you know, hanging in that window.
That's Melissa Howard talking about her inventory at Stock Vintage in Manhattan.
You know, a good majority of people, they would say, wow, this is like a beat up t-shirt that one would throw away. But to me, that's what I see the beauty in that. You know, these are very difficult to find, you know, just plain white cotton t-shirts that have, you know, holes that someone naturally made, or, you know, sometimes color distressing, not armpit stains, but, you know, I find real beauty in that.
You won't find any bespoke suits at Melissa's shop. These are cast-offs from America's working poor. Farmers, factory workers, truckers, even inmates.
I recently acquired a prisoner's outfit from the 1940s, and it came from Joplin, Missouri. And it's very unusual to find a prisoner's outfit because people tend not to preserve prisoner's outfits just because, for the obvious reasons. What's really unique about this particular piece is the man was actually shot in prison, and you can see the bullet holes in the back of the jacket. So I have the jacket and the pants.
Believe it or not, people actually buy these clothes to wear. But what's even more surprising is who's buying them.
I would say anywhere from 30 to 50% of my buyers are Japanese.
Thanks to Japan's passion for American workwear, jeans have become the new kimono.
No, I don't want you to go to the police. There were other people. Why should you be the only one involved?
But I am involved. We are all involved.
Iconic Hollywood movies like Rebel Without a Cause raised denim to cult status in Japan after World War II. Today, you can take a bus tour down Jeans Street in Kojima, where many world-class denim makers are based. Less well-known is the small but passionate group of Americans, myself included, who feel the same way about Japanese vintage workwear. My friend Steven Shipanik is the owner of Sri Threads, a Japanese textile gallery in Greenpoint, Brooklyn. It's filled with indigo kimonos, naragi jackets, and aprons, all of them handmade from rags, carefully patched and repatched to a point that transcends function and approaches the sublime. The Japanese refer to this kind of clothing as boro, which means tattered or broken. And as Stephen explains, the look had nothing to do with fashion. Workers wanted cotton to keep warm.
They couldn't afford to buy it in as, you know, finished garment, but they bought the scraps and they put them back together again, and that's why it looks like it looks. This kind of visual cacophony that's very kind of cohesive at the same time.
The broken clothing of Japanese farmers and fishermen sounds like a really esoteric niche thing, but Stephen's clients include some of the biggest names in the American fashion industry, and once you see boro, you'll notice its influence everywhere. From mass-produced rugs to last year's Louis Vuitton men's collection. So what's with this American-Japanese dual fascination with each other's heirloom clothing?
I think it has to do with a kind of romanticism. So when you don't understand something, you can bring your own sense of nostalgia to it, which is maybe completely misplaced. But I do think that, you know, when I look at this stuff, for example, I dream about those days in old Japan, very much like I think Japanese vintage denim dealers have this kind of cinematic view of the old West, maybe.
We have like a similar association to the frontier spirits of America.
Hisashi Oguchi is co-owner of Hickory's, a menswear store in Brooklyn that's launching their own hybrid Japanese-American line of jeans, and he agrees with Stephen's theory of misplaced nostalgia. Until 150 years ago, Hisashi tells me, Japan was a feudal system, ruled by a shogun family who promoted an austere, simple lifestyle, really not so far from the self-sustainable ethos in vogue today.
Workers sort of simple life, looking for better life. That's sort of like my opinion about how Japanese people get so attracted to it. It's like we lost that, like, you know, in this modern day Japan, all of that is gone. So
those days are gone in the U.S. too. 100 years ago, Americans just burned old clothes they couldn't use anymore. Today, the prison uniform hanging in the window of Stock Vintage sells for $4,500. Melissa tells me these are exactly the one-of-a-kind items that bring her Japanese buyers to the U.S. Worthless or priceless, it's not just how you look at it. It's where you come from. For the world, this is Alina Simone from New York.
I had trouble imagining boro until I saw some pictures. It's kind of amazing. You should see for yourself. We have photos of boro shirts, vests, and leggings, and also that $4,500 prison uniform complete with bullet holes. They're all at PRI.org. And coming up next time on The World.
When I went to school, you know, people would be like, "You're not black. You're not black. You Mexican or whatever, you know, because I'm Latin."
Latin and black in the Bay Area.
I'm like, bro, look at me, bro. You know what I'm saying? If I didn't speak Spanish, what do you think I am? You're going to think I'm black mixed with something, you know?
Panamanian-American duo Los Rakas. They mix up race, identity, and hip-hop in Spanish and English. Their story tomorrow on The World. This is PRI.
The World is brought to you by PRI with help from Lumosity.com, personalized brain training programs developed by neuroscientists to challenge memory, attention, and problem-solving through games. More at Lumosity.com.
I'm Carol Hills. This is The World. There is no free pass for your children to come to the United States. That was the message aimed at families in Central America that Homeland Security Secretary Jay Johnson delivered today in Arizona. He was there to tour a detention facility housing kids who've been detained alone at the border in recent months. Just since October, some 52,000 unaccompanied minors have been caught trying to enter the U.S. illegally. This is a humanitarian crisis that's also caught the attention of the United Nations. Leslie Velez is a senior protection officer at the UN's High Commissioner for Refugees. She's the lead author of the report Children on the Run, about minors fleeing into the U.S. across Mexico's border.
We heard stories from girls that had witnessed their classmates being sexually assaulted, and if they had resisted becoming a quote-unquote girlfriend of some of these criminal armed groups in their neighborhoods, then they were dismembered, actually, and their body parts thrown on the route to school as a reminder to the rest of the girls that they should not resist. So, I mean, these are the kinds of pressures that the children in these region are living under every day. And so it was the magnitude of the violence, I think, that really struck us.
So these are sort of criminal gangs in places like El Salvador and Guatemala and Honduras who are running the streets?
Yes, and I think to use the term gangs may be a bit outdated. To me, it conjures visions of Bloods and Crips in the United States or renegade youth when it's, I think, a lot more than that. What we do have in that region, and it's well documented, we have drug traffickers and we have criminal gang organizations, but that are now also transnational in nature as well, too.
Was there a typical story that you heard over and over again from the children that you interviewed?
Each child was unique, but there was one boy who told us that he actually didn't want to come. He didn't want to make this journey coming to the United States because he didn't want to leave his mother alone. But his younger sister, who was only 12, had already been attacked, and his mother begged him to go and make sure that she was protected along what's already well known to be a very dangerous journey. And so he did that. But he was extremely sensitive and scared about what was happening with his mother since he wasn't there to protect her.
Why are kids going across the border alone? What is dictating that? Is it their parents saying, go on, you need a better life? Why is that happening?
You know, one mother said this, and I think it frames it really nicely. She framed it as, I'd rather my child die en route to some form of safety than at my doorstep.
Wow. You've seen up close how the U.S. deals with unaccompanied minors crossing the border. How do U.S. policies compare with how other nations treat children crossing in alone?
The system is very well evolved in the United States, but it was a system that was designed to be able to accommodate between 6,000 and maybe 8,000 on heavy flow years. So it compares, but the system right now is extremely tested given that it's been 52,000 in the last 6 months for a system that was prepared to handle at a maximum around 8,000 over the course of a year.
Based on what you've seen around the world, do you think the U.S. is more lenient and therefore more likely to offer asylum than other countries?
52,000 children coming unaccompanied over the course of 6 months is a lot, and it is testing the U.S. system. But to put that into a global perspective, 10,000 children in 1 month here in the United States, I mean, we're talking about 10,000 people crossing the border into Jordan every day. And so Lebanon is a country of 4 million inhabitants, and it's currently hosting 1 million refugees. There's other countries, I think, that the U.S. has advocated for them to be open door hosting countries to allow refugees to be in there while more durable solutions can be looked for. And so I just hope that the United States lives up to its leadership in refugee protection.
Leslie Velez is with the United Nations High Commissioner for Refugees. She's authored a report on the rise in unaccompanied minors into the U.S. across the Mexican border. Thank you so much, Leslie.
Thank you so much, Carol.
Finally today, we hear some new music from Mexico, courtesy of our regular contributor, Beto Arcos.
Maroma is the new album by the band Pasatono Orquesta from Oaxaca. And it's like the Village Circus. It's named after music that's festive with a touch of nostalgia. A sort of eternal battle between sadness and joy. Here's the opening track called Obertura Maromera, or Circus Overture.
Dicen que arriba del cerro hay un mundo diferente, donde no llora la gente, donde no hay pena y lamento.
The new recording by this respected Oaxacan band that's been playing on the independent circuit for 15 years is dedicated to the Maroma Circus that's been traveling from village to village for more than a century. The Maroma has never included animals or big tops and concentrates on a clown who is a trapeze artist, a comic, and a wandering poet. Now, traditionally, the clown in the Village Circus is accompanied by a string band. So Pasatono Orquesta from the Mixteca region of Oaxaca reinvents the sound of the indigenous village bands with strings, brass, woodwinds, and percussion. Half of the repertoire of this new release, Maroma, includes their new arrangements of traditional music from these long nights of village circus, and these tunes are complemented by new pieces composed by the band's artistic director. Here's a piece called Maroma Indavi, which reflects the director's interest in minimalism and the tonality of his native Mixtec language. Pasatono Orquesta is made up of 9 musicians. Think of them as 21st century Oaxacans who move comfortably between the ancient and the modern. This new recording includes references to Dixieland jazz, which was popular in Mixtec villages in the 1940s. Now, there are melodic lines that come from Hungary via gypsy caravans that used to take cinema to the indigenous villages of the region, as well as polkas and pasodobles that come from Europe and took root in the local repertoire. I want to leave you with a piece called Sazón, a festive cumbia rumba with lots of sabor. Enjoy!
Our friend Beto Arcos telling us about Maroma, the latest album from Mexico's Pasatona Orquesta. You can watch what Beto calls a magic realism video for one of the band's tunes at PRI.org. That's all from us today from the Nan and Bill Harris studios at WGBH in Boston. I'm Carol Hills. We're back tomorrow.
The World is a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH Boston, supported in part by the PRI Global Reporting Fund, providing in-depth reporting on a diverse array of important topics, including global health. Donors to the fund include Marguerite Steed Hoffman and Blythe Brendan Mann Foundation, the PRI Ambassador Council, whose members include Peter Berge and Debbie Sitt, and Cindy and Howard Rachofsky, the WGBH Fund for Environmental Reporting, whose donors include the Grantham Foundation for the Protection of the Environment, supporting a cooperative approach to solving our critical environmental problems while we still can, and by the PRI Trust for Innovation, which enables informed risk-taking in the creation of new content for public radio. Donors to the trust include Peter and Catherine Darrow, the Tagney Jones Family Fund, and the Rose Family Fund.
PRI, Public Radio International.